My goal this week is
I mean,
to finish the visual alchemy material, and then we're not going to be completely done with it in the sense that the next year deals with bread and milk and cheese that is produced by a Nanjum. But for now, we're going to just deal with general cooking as we have been. And where we're going to move on to at this point is talking about cases in which a Bishul Akum is permitted. When is it permissible for a non-Jew to cook for me? Because we know from reality that that's the case. So just to review before I tell you where we're at, but what we've established over the last few weeks is that A, the primary reason for prohibiting non-Jews for cooking for Jews was because there was a concern of intermarriage. And so especially back then, now, again, now we could talk about how restaurants have changed their reality a little bit, but often if a non-Jew was cooking for you, so there was a little bit of camaraderie and Chazal were trying to prevent that. Last week we discussed that that food that is either edible raw or would not be served at a in a royal setting is not subject to the prohibitions of Bishul Akum. So actually, I'll show you quickly. If you want some specific examples of this, I found this this volume, Halakhically Speaking. Actually, hopefully not everyone can see it. This book, Halakhically Speaking, gives us some specific products and what goes on there. So it goes through a whole discussion. I'm not gonna go through this carefully, but you can see it deals with fish, which we talked a little bit about last week, sushi, French fries, which I mentioned. French fries again are not exactly the most regal of food options, so they're not subject to Bishul Akum. And ketchup is not subject to Bishul Akum, even if it's there's cooking of tomatoes in the process. So you can so if you want this link, I'm happy to I'll put it in the chat. And I'm happy to email it later. If you want to go through some more specific examples, but those were the general principles that we talked about. I think that's more or less where we left off. And we said that liquids also, even though when it comes to Shabbos, we would say that boiling a liquid is considered cooking it. For the purpose of Bishul Akum, it's not really a problem. There is a prohibition of Shechar Akum, of what's defined as beer or date beer, of a non-Jew that comes up, and that leads to questions of are Jews allowed to go to bars? Jews allowed to go to coffee shops? So the coffee thing actually does come up there a little bit. I don't know if it's, I don't think it's actually discussed in this volume. So, yeah, maybe towards the end. Maybe towards the end of the volume, it's going to come up. I don't know exactly, but so there are things with drinks and obviously wine. So, but for all intents and purposes, if a non-Jew, boils me a cup of hot water for tea or coffee, we generally say that that's permitted. Okay, so now we're going to talk about. So what are the leniencies in terms of Bishul Akum? How do we make it possible for non-Jews to cook on our behalf, which is obviously something that's very relevant in many cases. So on page 76, this is source 28 on page 76. So there's a principle in halacha, pesha asar, pesha hiter, that if that the one who prohibited is also allowed to come up with the cases of permission. So on the one hand, Chazal created the stringencies of Bishul Akum, but they also give us some of the leniencies, and they have that prerogative. The Gemara of Odazara says in source 28, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Hiniach Yisrael basar al gabi kechalim. So if a Jew puts meat on the grill, Uva goy v'hafach bo, and then the non-Jew comes and flips it over, which causes, let's say, you have a piece of you have a hamburger. So the Jew puts the hamburger on the grill. Non-Jew comes and flips it, and then the other side's cooking. So the psak there is mutter. That's acceptable. Itmar namim, Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, bein shiniach goy v'hafach Yisrael. So whether the non-Jew originally put it on and the Jew flipped it over, or whether Bein She'niach Yisrael V'Hafach Goy, where the Jew puts it on, the non-Jew flips it over, Mutar Ve'Eino Asar Ad Shetehe Tchilaso V'Gmaro B'Yad Goy. So Rabbi Yochanan comes and tells us that that it's not just the case where a Jew puts it on the grill and the non-Jew flips it, but even if it's the other way around, it doesn't really matter. As long as the Jew participated in the cooking process at some point, we don't have to worry about a Bishul Akum. So, as you can imagine, there are lots of different extremes to which this can be taken, right? Let's say, on one hand, we'll talk about if a Jew merely ignites the fire, if that's sufficient. And at the same time, we could also wonder, let's say it's, 1/920 cooked, but then the Jew came and did something to finish it. So is that also acceptable? So we could look at it from both extremes. In source 29, the Rambam writes that permitted whether the Jew did a little bit at the beginning or at the end. So let's say a Jew puts a piece of meat on the grill, or he put a pot on the stove, and then the Jew comes and flips over the hamburger, or he stirs the pot. Or the Jew put it on, and the non-Jew finished it. So that is permissible. That is permissible. So the Rambam codifies exactly what we have in the Gemara. So something that came up over the course of time, as I hinted at just a minute ago, was if we're saying that if a Jew begins the process, that's sufficient, and if we take that, as a very literal thing, so what's the beginning of the cooking process? So in theory, it's turning on the fire, it's or igniting the fire. So this is something that comes up in the Rishonim. The Beit Yosef, which again is the, you have the Shulchan Aruch, so the Beit Yosef was the expanded version that set the path for the Shulchan Aruch to be finished up. So in the Beit Yosef, he quotes Rabbeinu Nissim that when it came to bread specifically, and again, we'll get to the prohibition, bread, a non-Jew making bread for a Jew is a separate category, which we'll talk about Mirtzeh Hashem next week. But with bread, it was said that if a Jew ignited the fire and the non-Jew baked the bread, that's allowed. But the Beit Yosef says the davka bepat, that's only true when it comes to bread. But when it comes to when he says aval bishar tavshilin, when it comes to other cooked items, low. And he brings a proof from the concept shufetes isha gedera v'aminan hiniach basar al gabei kachalim. The Gemara had said that, let's say, if a woman put the pot on the stove, or if a Jew placed the meat upon the flames, that means mashma d'adlakas ha'esh b'lchud lo mehanin. Meaning, the case in the Gemara was that the fire is already ignited, but the Jew initially put on the hamburger, and then the non-Jew kind of finished grilling it. What the Gemara did not say was that the Jew merely turned on the fire. So, and this is a fairly logical way of approaching it. So the Beit Yosef is saying that igniting the fire alone is not sufficient to get rid of the prohibition of Bishul Akum. So he goes on to say, he quotes Rabbeinu Yonah. So let's say again, you have you're cooking something. It's in a pan. So the Jew has to put the pan into the oven in order for it to cook. So certainly, stoking the fire or igniting the fire would not be enough. And the Rivash, another Rishon, seems to agree with it. So what we get that from the Beit Yosef is a very strong ruling that igniting the fire is not sufficient to get rid of the need for Bishul Akum. So once a Jew A, ignited the fire, even if a non-Jew ignited the fire. But if a Jew did something that, because if you think about it, if I ignite the fire, right, so the oven can just be on and can and nothing could happen, right? It's only when I put that thing that needs to be cooked in the oven on top of the grill that that begins the process of cooking it. It's a very logical position. However, turn the page 78, source 31. The Darkei Moshe, which is the Ramah of Moshe Isserles, who again provided the Ashkenazi glosses of the Shulchan Aruch, but before the Shulchan Aruch came into being, he was already responding to Rav Yosef Karo, who was writing the Beit Yosef. So the Ramah is writing the Darkei Moshe, and he quotes the in the middle. He quotes Bidivrei Maharai, which is Rav Yisrael Isserlin, who's the author of a known of a work called the Trumat Hadeshen. Trumat Hadeshen is an interesting work because it's a work of it's a work in which Rav Isserlin answers questions, but they were sort of hypothetical questions. They were realistic, but they weren't questions that were actually posed to him. They were questions that he came up with that he wanted to answer. So Rav Yisrael Isserlin writes that Noagin Lahatir Bishulei Hashfachos Goyas. So if I have a non-Jewish maidservant, so she's allowed to cook for me. Because inevitably the Jew's going to stoke at least one of the coals. Meaning, like if the non-Jewish woman's cooking at home, but somebody in the household is going to be doing something in the process. So maybe the maidservant is helping in a certain way, but the Jew's at least going to have ended up stoking one of the coals. The Ramah learns from this mashba de pashut lahati ari dei. So it sounds like stoking the coals is enough. And likewise, he quotes a book called the Aruch as saying lahati ari dei chitui veshlachas kisim. So there's enough grounds to permit a Jew to stoke or throw a chip of wood into the fire that would make it that would be considered cooking by a Jew. Okay, so the Ramah and Beit Yosef have a strong disagreement. Ramah says if I stoke the coals, if I turn on the fire, that should be significant. That should be sufficient. Beit Yosef strongly disagrees with that. That's not enough. In source 32, we get a little bit more of that as well. Quotes the Mordechai, where he the way he presents the Mordechai as saying that chitui mahane, that stoking is a fine. Okay, let's get to the practical halacha on page 79, source 33. So Shulchan Aruch comes out very explicitly in source 33 as saying, "En shgiras hatanur mo'alas al bapas," that igniting the fire, starting the fire, is only effective for bread, but when it comes to other cooked foods, igniting the fire, turning on the oven would not be sufficient. Ela nacha dafka. You specifically have to place the food on the fire. Again, it's a very logical position because you can turn on the oven, but no food's going to get cooked unless it gets put in there. So it's the person who's putting the food into the oven that's actually causing that particular item to get cooked. So that's what the Mechaber Rav Yosef Karo says. However, the Ramah writes where it says Haga, the glosses of the Ramah. So he says, "V'yesh cholkein u'svir luhud adlakas ha'esh ochitui b'gechal mahane le'inyan bishul k'mol le'inyan pas." V'chein no'agin. Rama says, "No, this is not just for bread, but igniting the fire or soaking the coals is effective to make it as if a Jew cooked it, and it doesn't matter if it's bread or anything else that's being cooked." And he goes even further to say, "V'yesh amrim dafil ochita Yisrael." Even if a Jew didn't soak the coals, he didn't ignite the fire. If a Gentile lights a fire from a fire of another Jew, so let's say it's like Yontif, and you have the Yisker candle lit, and the non-Jewish housekeeper, takes a match from the Yisker candle, turns on, ignites the stove, and then she cooks the whole thing from beginning to end. So that's also considered to be sufficient to consider it to have been cooked by a Jew. So that's a very significant, leniency that the Ramah has. That means, practically speaking, that let's say you have a in a restaurant situation, A mashgiach can come in at the beginning of the day, turn on the oven, and leave. And the non-Jews could be cooking everything the rest of the day. Right? That's the implication of this ruling of the Rambam. Rabbi Vadia Yosef brings sort of an opposite case, which is interesting. So let's say a non-Jew puts the pot on the stove, and then the Jew comes and lights a fire. So what would be the halacha there? So Rabbi Yosef says that even for Sfaradim who followed Rav Karo, who followed the Mechaber and Shulchan Aruch, so that would be sufficient. But again, in that case, igniting the fire is already initiating the process of cooking the thing that's on the fire. So Rabbi Yosef is saying that there, the pot's already on the stove, and then the Jew lights the fire, so that's going to be fine for everybody. But if the Jew lights the fire, and then at some point later, the food gets put on the stove or put in the oven, so that's going to be a problem. Okay. So page 80, verse 35. Again, so one extreme in theory is is that the Jew turns on the fire and the rest of the process is being done by a non-Jew. But let's say the non-Jew turned on the fire, started cooking it. So at one point, and we said that that's fine, that the Jew could finish the process. We said that a Jew could finish the process, and if the non-Jew started it. So at one point, if that hamburger is on the grill, at what point do we say that it's too late for the Jew to have been involved in cooking it? I meaning, obviously, if the hamburger is like fully cooked and it's fully cooked in and out, and so the fact that the Jew comes and flips it or moves it around a little bit, so it's cooked at that point. So how do we define that? So in source 35, this is also from the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo, he says in Bishul Goy Kemalcha Ben Drusai. Okay, so let me explain what Malcha Ben Drusai is. Ben Drusai was a bandit who was always on the run. So the way that he ate his food was like half raw. It's machlokas between Rambam and Rashi whether it's half raw or if it's a third cook or half cooked. But Ben Drusai was willing to eat food that was only a third or half cooked because he's always on the run. He didn't have enough time to it's like lahavdil. It's like with the matzah, right? Dough didn't have enough time to rise. So like here, it's like the hamburger didn't have enough time to cook. So Ben Drusai would cook it a little bit and then run. So that has implications in terms of, for Shabbos and for this when it comes to cooking. So at what point do we consider something to be edible enough that is considered to be cooked, which again doesn't have to mean that it's cooked to the extent that everybody would like it. But what's the threshold for considering something cooked? So Shulchan Aruch says that if a non-Jew cooked a piece of meat, kemalcha ben drusai, up to the point where it's, let's say, half cooked, ugmaru Yisrael, and then a non-Jew finish, and then a Jew finish it, yesh la'asar. So, if there was a case of pressing need that it's Erev Shabbos or Erev Yom Tov, you don't have a lot of time. You can't start over. You don't have time. So, as long as it was not fully cooked, so then the Jew can participate. But otherwise, Rav Yosef Karo says, once it's already, again, third or half cooked, not getting to the machlokas right now, but once it's a third or half cooked, so then it's already too late for the Jew to participate in the cooking process. However, the Rama says that it's permitted Ish Matim B'chol Inyan as long as the Jew participated at some point. Obviously, once it's fully cooked, then it's too late for the Jew to have said that he participated in the process. But until that point, it would be sufficient. So that's the ruling of the Rama. That would obviously work for Ashkenazim. By the way, here the in on top here, they define Malcha Ben Drusai as being a third cook. Okay. The Menachas Asher says in source 36, Menachas Asher is Rav Asher Weiss, should live and be well in lives in Yerushalayim, has a whole following in Yerushalayim. So he says it would seem that all of the meat was already roasted over time, So okay, so sorry. The question here was when it comes to shawarma. When it comes to shawarma, if you've been to a falafel shawarma shop, so you know the shawarma is cooking like on this, you know, on this spigot that's like, you know, on the fire, and it's constantly rotating. So the question is, as you shave off the meat to give to the customer, so the meat that's still on the, you know, that's on the stick is getting cooked even better because there's like less, you know, there's less stuff there, so it allows it to cook better. The question is, could a non-Jew cut off the pieces of shawarma when the inner pieces would get cooked better at that point? So Michal Sasher says that it would seem that all of the meat was already roasted over time, and this cutting it off is only indirectly causing it to cook more. So since the primary part of the cooking, placing the meat on and lighting the fire, was done by a Jew, one may permit it. That seems to be pretty pashut. At that point, you know, when the shawarma is rotating on the vertical rotisserie, so at that point it's pretty much cooked, I think. So we don't have a problem there. Okay. Very fascinating question, of course. We said that according to the Ramah, a non-Jew, sorry, Jew can turn on the fire. That's sufficient. Rav Yosef Karo disagrees. So, what do people who have, let's say, back in the day, servants or housekeepers? Some people have help at home who do a lot of the food prep and whatnot. So, what are the parameters there? So, the Rashba in source 37, Rashba, which keep in mind is a Sephardi. So he says, I'll read this in English. Some of my teachers have suppressed the halacha prohibiting the cooking of our servants and maidservants to permit it. The reason they give for their opinion is that the prohibition of cooking is only due to the decree concerning intermarriage. But somebody who has somebody working for them, that's not going to create a closeness that would lead to marriage. And it's like that's a professional relationship and maybe not the friendliest of relationships at times. Always treat our workers well, but it's still it's a power dynamic that doesn't necessarily lead itself to marriage. So that was a reason to permit perhaps a non-Jew who's working in a Jewish home to cook. But the Rashba disagrees with this. Their words do not seem correct in our eyes. We do not rely upon it. Rather, we treat their cooking as forbidden, even b'dieved, even after the fact. Rashba says that if I have help at home, again, you know, there, at that point we're talking. Frankly, we're talking about servants or slaves, not paid housekeepers, and that's going to be a point of discussion. But Rashba feels that that even if they're working for you, and maybe it's not a relationship that leads itself to great friendship, it's still prohibited. Okay, so that. You know, again, when the Gemara says that the concern was a concern of intermarriage, so you know that the question is like, you know, well, once a particular case, every case that doesn't have to do with the possibility of intermarriage, so can we automatically, you know, dismiss that as not being relevant to Bishalakum? So, and on one hand, you could say, well, this is what the Gemara decreed, and even though, yes, maybe not in every single case, it's going to lead to intermarriage. But there were some who said that, well, if there's a really clear proof that it's not a situation where the person cooking is going to be somebody that is going to marry into the family, so that's the machlokas here. So Shulchan Aruch writes in source 38, Yeshbisha matir b'shvachos shalanu. Some say that cooking can be done by our maidservants, v'yeshbisha oser v'afil b'diyevet, and some prohibit it even b'diyevet. And Shulchan Aruch seems to agree with those who prohibit it. And again, it makes sense because Rashba was a Sephardi, Rabbi Yosef Karo was a Sephardi. So that's the kind of the Sephardic line of thinking about this. However, the Ramah says that after the fact, you can rely on those who allow it. And he says, even lechatchila, even, you know, even in, it, when you're trying to do the most ideal thing, the custom is to be lenient in the house of the Jew, where the servants and maidservants cook in the house of the Jew, since it's impossible that one of the household members does not stoke the fire a small amount. So that goes back to what he said in Darkei Moshe, that you're allowed to have a non-Jewish servant or maidservant cook for you. Even if it looks like they're doing the whole thing, but inevitably, somehow or another, Drew's going to have stoked one of the coals, and so he or she's going to have participated in the process. So we don't have a problem if particularly at home. The implication of that being is that let's say a servant who outside your home, so they still can't cook for you, at least not without the Jew having explicitly participated. But within my own home, and it's my own servant. So comes a shach. Shach is the Siftei Kohen, who is one of the main commentators on Yoredeya, Yoredeya section of Shulchan Aruch, where we find Hilchos Kashrus. So the shach says that we have a problem with the Ramah, because the Ramah had said that the servants and maidservants who work in the home of a Jew, so they can cook for the Jew because the Jew is going to inevitably stoke the fire a little bit. But the Shach says, is that relevant nowadays? Because there's a difference between earlier times and current times. And this is, again, the Shach speaking a few centuries ago. But he's saying that it could be that the leniency with servants and maidservants is when they were purchased, when they were owned. And such a servant or a maidservant, for example, is the owner's allowed to, is required to have them observe Shabbos, or that's in the Ten Commandments. But that's not the case when it comes to servants or maidservants who are hired. And so Shach says in the bold source 39, but in our locale, that we don't own them. They are hired for a year, okay, maybe a few years, but hired for a particular amount of time, and they're paid. And likewise, we're not commanded to have them observe Shabbos. So it's a fundamentally different category when you're talking about somebody who is hired help versus somebody who is, an actual like slave. So the Shach presents four possibilities of what the Ramah meant in terms of the leniencies, and there's different implications for the question of can hired help a cook for a Jew. So that depends on which one of the Shach's interpretations of the Ramah that we hold by. So one possibility is that when the Ramah was talking, so he was talking, in fact, only talking about the shvachos, the maidservants that the Mechaber was talking about, even if they're in the Ramah's locale, they didn't have servants and maidservants who were owned. But that's the case he was talking about, which case it would really not be relevant nowadays. Possibility number two is that we're talking specifically about when the non-Jew is cooking in the Jew's home, and it's that particular person. So that would seem to, of course, open up a leniency that if that hired help could, even what it doesn't matter what their status is in terms of what kind of help they're providing, but they would be allowed to cook in the home of the Jew that they work for. Possibility number three is that we're talking about a case where the Ramah was very specific that he only allowed a non-Jew to cook for a Jew, even within the Jew's home, in the situation where one of the household members will certainly stir it a little bit. Right? He says that, so the Ramah seemed to be saying that it's possible, or it's impossible that none of them are going to be stirring it. But what the Shach is saying, that the Ramah really would require that. That it has to be that certainly that one of the Jews would be stoking the coals a little bit, in which case that would mean that that would mean that the Jews involved in the process anyway. So that seems to be seems to fit pretty well. Of course, that consideration is not necessarily relevant because you don't have to go by and stoke the coals a little bit at all. That's a very different kind of situation. So to find a possibility in terms of what the Ramah was talking about was that what we had seen in the Reshba that maidservants and servants. So they're not so we're not so close with them, that there's a sort of power dynamic. There's a there's a boss and there's a worker. So that doesn't engender the kind of closeness that would lead it to marriage. although parenthetically, is that really true? I don't know, but in terms of Matthias, I don't know if that's true, but even if it were, so the Rashba didn't want to rely on that, but maybe the Rama is saying that b'di'evad, since there wouldn't be that sort of closeness, that it would be permitted. In which case, right, so if we go by this fourth opinion, so perhaps it would be that hired workers, since it's a work relationship and there's a power dynamic, so maybe there's not that same kind of closeness. So practically speaking, again, depending on how one interprets Rama based on these considerations of the Shach, so how does the halacha turn out here? So generally speaking, we do not allow hired help to cook for a Jew. You'd have to follow the regular rules of Bishul Akum. So for an Ashkenazi, that could mean turning on the fire, igniting the fire, being involved with someone in the cooking process, but you couldn't leave the non-Jew to do it completely from beginning to end. However, the Chokas Binyamin, or Binyamin Cohen, who's the son of Revival Cohen, who was the author of Bade Shulchan, who we've mentioned before, so he says that as far as who we're talking about, the servants are hired and not acquired, and also that the cooking takes place in the home of the Jew, one may be lenient b'di'evad. So when we're talking about somebody who's hired, when it's being done in the home of the Jew, so again, we wouldn't generally allow somebody to purposely set up that situation, but once a non-Jew cooked for the Jew, so then after the fact it would be permitted. So the question that comes up for Sephardim, so a lot of what we've been talking about, a lot of the leniencies apply to Ashkenazim, because the Rama says that gives these examples where if a Jew turned on the fire, et cetera, that's sufficient. So Sephardim, however, don't generally try to not rely on this. So what does Sephardim do? And this comes up, of course, in Israel. Let's say Sephardi wants to eat in a restaurant and or hotel, and the workers are Arab, and the hashgacha is an Ashkenazi hashgacha. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're relying on the on these leniencies that Sephardim don't generally rely on. So maybe ideally, one should not rely on these leniencies. However, Rav Avadya Yosef is willing to provide a limud. He's willing to defend the practice on the following grounds. This is on page 84 and source 41, called a sfeika, right? Two uncertainties. We have two uncertainties, so those can add up to sort of mitigate the severity of the situation. So Rav Avadya Yosef says in source 41, perhaps halacha follows the poskim who hold that Bishul Akum is also permitted when the Jew lights the fire. So he says on the one hand, maybe halacha really does follow the Rama. If you know Rav Avadya Yosef, he was very, very felt very strongly that Sephardim rely on Mechaber and Yosef Karo. He was the posek for all generations going forward for Sephardim. However, he says as a potential leniency, so maybe the Rama is correct. And even if you don't hold like the Rama, perhaps halacha is like those that say that with hired employees in the Jew's home, one can be lenient. So that would suggest that even it sounds like even in the case of a restaurant, there's what to rely on. So he says in conclusion, page 85, even Sephardim and those of Eidot HaMizrach have what to rely on to stay and eat in hotels and restaurants that are kosher by the local rabbanut, even if the chef is a Gentile, since the Jew who is a mashkiach lights the fire. Et cetera. And again, there's other leniencies. But he says that one who wants to be strict, can be strict. The Or LeZion and Rav Ben Zion Abba Shaul disagrees with this situation. And he says that Sephardim should not eat in restaurants where the people making the food are not Jewish, unless a Jew is having a more significant role in the process. Page 86. So the discussion comes up whether or not. So there's a principle of we mentioned this before. Kavush kamavushal. Something something is pickled, so that can be considered cooking in some situations. And same if something salted for 24 hours, that can also be considered cooking. But when it comes to Bishul Akum, That is not that's not relevant. So if something's, say pickled for 24 hours, we don't have to worry about bishulakum in those cases. That is explicit in the Rama. Rav Asher Weiss, source 45 on page 87, discusses whether microwaves are considered cooking. So he says, so again, when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, I would not turn on a microwave and cook. We would consider that to be a violation of Bishul. It says for these purposes, ideally one would not have a non-Jew make something that's something that's raw that becomes edible, and that process happens in the microwave. Maybe that's not ideal. However, he says b'shas hadchak, if there's a pressing situation, so if somebody has a worker in their own home or something of the like, so maybe there's a reason to be lenient there. He says, especially when you're talking about someone who's ill. So somebody, let's say, who's homebound and they have an aide. So can the aide, first of all, maybe a lot of these leniencies even would apply with an oven. But especially with the microwave, we'd have many grounds to be lenient. And the Sefer Kashrus also points out, if it's not obvious, that something that was cooked but was cold and has to be heated up, so that's obviously not subject to Bishul Akum. We don't have a problem there. Very last issue that comes up, sorry, I'm moving a little bit quickly with a minute and a half left, but on page 88 and 89, so the discussion comes up so let's say a non-Jew does cook something, from beginning to end on utensils that belong to a Jew. So are those utensils now treif, right? Do we consider it like they made meat and dairy together? That like someone made meat and dairy together on that utensil and it's prohibited? Or maybe since this is just an enactment of Chazal, seems to be, there are other leniencies involved, so maybe that's not the case. The Rashba thought that if a non-Jew cooks on your utensils, you have to kasher them. The Rush disagreed with that. So Shulchan Aruch holds like the Rush, gives two opinions. Some say that you have to kasher it, some say you don't have to kasher it, but when the Shulchan Aruch says, gives an opinion of that, and then says, well, some other people say that you don't have to do it. So it seems like the Shulchan Aruch holds that that utensils used cooked on by Gentiles require kashering. However, the Shach says that after the fact, and maybe you try not to do that, but after the fact is what to rely on, especially if there's rov, if there's more food than the utensil itself, so it could be permitted. Okay, so this is the basic outline of Bishulakum, in terms of when it's permitted, the basis for it, different examples of it, and we'll go on to things related to bread, milk, and cheese, and Mirtzah Hashem next week. Have a good
Thank
week.
you.
Thank you.